Well, hello everyone. I've often talked about how culture is top down and not bottom up. And in this video, we're going to look at an applied example using one based on history, but I'm going to try to abstract it out and move through the actual stages of what various people in organized minorities need to do in order to, quote unquote, hack a culture from the top down. Before we get going, I'll just remind everyone, pick up a course at the Academic Agency. You can pick up the Trivium there, bestseller, or if you're into culture, Foundations of Shakespeare is available. But let's not waste any further time, because what we're going to do here, I'm going to take a real-life worked example, and we're going to work through the stages and the obstacles that the people who want to make the cultural change happen would have to overcome in order to, quote unquote, hack a culture. So here's the challenge, okay? You want to supplant what music is popular now in the culture with your own new genre, okay? That is the challenge. You have a culture that is resistant to this new thing that you want to bring in. You want to supplant the old culture and bring in this new culture. How are you going to do it, okay? Well, there are numerous challenges and obstacles in your way. Here's problem number one. The public simply prefers the rival genres. You've put your genre out there, but they just don't want to go and watch it. They don't want to go to your shows. They don't want to buy your records. They don't want, they're not buying tickets. They just don't want to know. Here's the second problem. The critics hate it. Here's old Addison DeWitt, absolutely ghastly, he says. A shocking affront to decency, taste, and all that is good in the world. This new genre is such an assault on the ears. I would be surprised if it lasts past the summer. So, and this is a problem, of course, because old Addison, he has a very influential column, lots of, the who's who, the tastemakers, if you want, read him, get their opinions from him. And he has taken against your new genre. This is a problem for you. Third problem, venues won't book your acts. There's old Carnegie Hall. Can you tell me how to get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, man, practice. And, they're just not taking your new genre. They don't want your act. Get lost, they say. We're not having that filth on here. This is a respectable establishment. This is a respectable music venue. Not having your rubbish. You hear what Addison DeWitt said? We're not having you here. And the fourth, people, especially well-to-do types like the people we're seeing here, see your genre as low class. They see it as anti-aspirational and low class. So this guy was asked if he'd go to your music show, and he was like, absolutely not. A disgusting carry-on. And the guy on the right, I'd sooner gargle poison than attend such a grotesque display. So now, you're faced with basically a culture hostile to what you want to bring in. So how are you gonna go about, engineering this out? This is a real issue. People aren't buying your records. Critics hate what you're doing. Nobody will book your acts. And, you're facing attitudes like this on the high street. So, the first thing you don't do is you don't take no for an answer. Okay, the public don't want it. That's not going to stop us, because we're determined, aren't we? We're determined to make the change we want to see. So don't give up. So here's the first solution. Okay, the public prefers rival genres. Well, that's not going to stop you. First thing you do, you close off the ability of rival genres to get out there, okay? The second thing you do is you establish a monopoly on the publishing houses that put music out there, okay? Or the record labels, if you want to use more modern terminology. The third thing you do is you use cartel tactics and other methods to crowd out any new upstart that try to come in, okay? Oh, we don't want to do your new genre. We're doing this genre over here because people like that. Well, you need to find ways to stomp on them using basically mafia-like behavior. And fourth, you ensure that to make it in this industry, okay, acts, music acts, artists, writers need fidelity to your publishing house and the publishing houses that you and your group control. And going with any upstart is a career ender. Say, I can make you a star, kid. I can make you a star. But if you want to be a star, you have to be part of my gang. If you want to be a star, you work with me and my guys. You don't go over there. Otherwise, you're going to be the opposite of a star. You'll never work in this town again. Now, you may think that this is all kind of, hyperbole or stereotype or joke. It's not. And few industries in history have been more ruthless in this manner than show business. I mean, I even know from my own knowledge of pro wrestling, for example, you know, Vince McMahon, love him or hate him, he used basically all of these tactics at one time or another. He also successfully broke a cartel early in his career. But he used all of these tactics. You know, he threatened and bullied, networks and so on, that if they showed the product of his rival, you wouldn't get him. Or, you know, he blacklisted people. And that was in the 80s, okay? So this is just like how, you know, the entertainment biz works in some respects. But it's also like, if you have the dream or the plan of hacking the culture, of making your thing, putting your thing in front of the people rather than some other thing, basically these sorts of tactics seem like they have been necessary, especially if you're facing a skeptical public. And let's face it, the public is often skeptical. I mentioned pro wrestling. That was one of the huge taboos to overcome, that it was, you know, all of those things would also apply to Vince in the 1980s, for example. But anyway, let's stick with the music idea. Second problem and second solution. The critics hate it. Well, the first thing you do is you personally attack, hound, and ridicule the individual critics who have taken against your genre. Maybe old Addison DeWitt finds himself, you know, caught up in some sort of scandal. Oh, Addison DeWitt, he's a sex pest or something like this. Or, oh, Addison DeWitt, he's been caught taking money. Or Addison DeWitt, he's just an old idiot. But, you know, do you find some way to discredit that voice? You isolate the target and you discredit his voice, okay? You take away the problem by lessening his influence. Another strategy is to embed friendly critics in key newspapers, or, failing that, simply just set up your own newspaper. If you've got the money and the resources, you could do that as well. Now, there could be an issue where this critic is too powerful or too influential to simply just replace, or, you know, get him fired, or, you know, damage his reputation. Maybe he just won't go, or maybe he's just too well established. So what you need to do then is set up a dialectic whereby his stance, his belligerent stance against your thing, is actually a boon to you, okay? In this dynamic, your genre is new, it's hip, it's trendy, it's cool, okay? And this old codger is a fuddy-duddy, he's old-fashioned, he's boring, he's miserable, he's a stuck-in-the-mud, he's a prude, and so on and so forth, okay? And once you've set up that dialectic, the attacks of the old critic can then be worn as a badge of pride, okay? So this is another way of overcoming the obstacle and creating the culture hack, okay? Solution number three, the venues won't book your act. Well, I mean, first and foremost, you can use blackmailing, bullying tactics, the old mafia tactics, right, to try to force the venues to book your acts and not to book the acts of the other genres. That's one way. You can try to infiltrate the venues so that the manager of the venue is friendly to you, one of your guys. Okay, I mean, you just think of a landscape where your guys are little blue circles, right? And all of the people who are hostile to you, or all of the rest of culture, normie culture, is red circles. You want to replace all the red circles with blue circles in as many cases as possible, right? Now, here we have a key decision maker, a little node of control that is preventing you from getting your act in. Now, most normal people would just say, oh, well, he said, no, we can't. What are we going to do? We can't book Carnegie, right? That's not like if you're truly a kind of vanguard, right? A close-knit collective who moves in unison. And you're just not going to take that as an answer. It'll be like, right, we need to replace that red node with one of our blue nodes. We need to flip that node to make him friendly to us, one way or the other. Okay. Failing that, you could simply just buy the venue. If you've got enough money, you could just buy out the venue. I don't know how much it would be to cost to buy Carnegie Hall, right? But you just need to somehow make him friendly. Okay. You can use friendly critics and newspapers to publicly attack venues who won't play ball, right? Now, let's pretend that you can't get your bloke in to manage Carnegie. You can't influence the owner. You know, your bullying and your blackmail has failed and they've just stuck by their guns. Well, then you use your newspaper, your newspapers and your friendly critics and your writers and so on, just to relentlessly attack Carnegie Hall. You know, it's not what it used to be. It's old fashioned. It's funny. You know, it has become, a symbol of everything wrong with America today. It's racist. You know, you name it. You just find something to fling at Carnegie until they cave, right? And, you can imagine the scenario. We're under new management now, and we will move boldly into the future by embracing new styles. Oh, brilliant. Okay, so now you've got your way. Now, if you're looking to hack the culture, you actually got a huge prestige venue here in Carnegie, and that in itself will move mountains. And problem number four, people see your genre as low class and anti-aspirational. But this is actually downstream of the other three problems, okay? Now, the solution to this is you turn that perception on its head by using friendly media. You turn that perception on its head by using friendly media to push the message relentlessly. This new genre is the best thing going today. All of the cool kids are doing this. This new genre, if you're not doing it, there's something wrong with you. I tell you what, this new genre is, I mean, it is the best thing since Jesus, okay? Second, target the sources of prestige. We saw the example of Carnegie Hall there, okay? That's a prestige venue. If you can get the prestige venues, the prestige publications on board, you've won half the battle already, okay? Attack the alternatives as low class, okay? Now, it could be that the thing that you're attacking, like opera, for example, or classical music, these are some historic examples that have actually happened. Carnegie won't book your new thing because they keep on putting on Mozart concerts, right? Mozart or Beethoven. Well, you're not going to be able to convince people that Mozart and Beethoven are low class, right? But you can paint them as boring, outmoded, old-fashioned, etc., staid, right? There is a way of just changing the perception, change the vibe, okay? People now, right, like to talk about quote-unquote vibe shifts. But how does a vibe shift actually happen? It's not some magic. It's not something, oh, something's in the air. People in key places push the message of the vibe shift using key nodes of influence and control in exactly the manner I've outlined here. Okay? And if they all start saying it at the same time, then lo and behold, people will perceive the quote-unquote vibe shift. But in reality, the vibe has not like shifted of its own accord. It has been pushed. It has been forced in a particular way by people with vested interests. Okay. And finally, once you have key nodes of high society and tastemakers, the public will program, right? They'll follow you. They'll follow the people, the tastemakers, and they'll actually believe it's their own opinion. They'll actually believe they've always thought this way. Okay. That the taste that they have is their own kind of predilections, their own dreams, okay? And in this way, you program their dream. Now, let's look at our two chaps here. Remember, before you did all this, absolutely not. Disgusting carry-on. I'd sooner gargle poison than attend such a grotesque display, remember? But now, oh, this new genre is the talk of the town. Bravo, bravo, I say. Oh, wonderful. Wonderful stuff. And this guy on the right, I always said this was exactly what music is about. Splendid stuff. Oh, wonderful. Now, if you think people are not as shallow, as easily manipulated, and as malleable as this, then you haven't paid attention to what has actually happened over the past 100 years, because this story that I told you actually happened in real life. This is the actual story of jazz in the 1910s. Every single stage of this that I've talked about actually happened in real life. The American public didn't like jazz in the 1910s, but it was pushed, it was pushed, it was relentless. All of these tactics, all of these solutions were put in. And so, you know, by the end of a decade of this, by the time you get to the mid-1920s or the early 1920s, there was, lo and behold, a quote-unquote vibe shift, because the tastemakers, the top-down process that I've talked about, had been, you know, had a, you know, more or less a decade of this relentless pushing, not taking no for an answer, and lo and behold, by about 1920, oh, jazz is the national music now, or whatever it was. Okay. Now, if you're interested in this, a very good book to read is Propaganda by Edward Bernays, one of the absolute masters of this. And he was writing around this time as well, a little bit later, 20s and 30s, he was around. And he recognized these methods and he further exploited them. And he made a lot of money, you know, reprogramming the dreams of the American public. One of his great successes, famously, was getting women to smoke by reframing the issue. By saying, well, cigarettes are liberty sticks. No, you're smoking a little bit of freedom there. It represents your freedom. Okay, and that was such a successful campaign that I still even know now. You know, I know at least one boomer now who's like, you know, absolutely won't give up smoking cigarettes because they believe it to be their little slice of liberty, you know. And that campaign was almost 100 years ago. So it's remarkable how successful these kind of culture, top-down culture hacking methods are. And, you know, if you don't believe this, if you don't believe this, the story of jazz, I mean, there's plenty of accounts of it. There are some accounts who are critical of it, of course, who say, oh, all of this happened and isn't it terrible how subversive it was and so on. There are other accounts who like jazz who say, oh, well, yes, all of these things happened and that's a good thing, right? Isn't it wonderful? Look at these pioneers who did all of these, you know, dirty tactics and so on. If they hadn't have done it, we wouldn't have had the awesome things that jazz brought us. Okay, so there are, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, a wholly negative thing, right? Depending on where you stand on that, but it is actually, as a matter of fact, what happened. It wasn't some organic process; it was deliberately engineered, okay, with a desired result in mind, by a close-knit group of people. And this has happened countless times before. Incidentally, one of these pictures there, the one on the bottom of the guys playing the trombones and so on, that was actually something that was put on by the American intelligence services, CIA, and the military as well. During the Cold War, the America kept on being attacked for being racist by the Soviet Union, okay? And so there was a massive push in the 1950s by the American government the American Secret Services, CIA, and the military to present jazz as the nation's national music and a celebration of and an example of the fact that America is not a racist nation, but in fact, you know, gives prominent roles to their black population. Right? That was an active government-led propaganda push. Okay, if you wonder why that song by Louis Armstrong, "It's a Wonderful World," went all around the world, right? All around the world it went. Okay, I know my dad, who grew up in Iran, remembers that song being played on the radio when he was a kid. It was literally American propaganda to get you to buy into an idea of America as a freedom-loving, cosmopolitan, non-racist place, as against the dour Soviet Union. Okay, that was literally what that was. And you can have a look in, I've got tons of books here on these sorts of ops that have happened. A great one is by Francis Stoner Saunders, which I mentioned before, called Who Paid the Piper. I don't know if she talks about jazz in that one, but can't remember now. But yeah, I mean, this information is out there if you just go digging enough. Another person of note, of course, is Antonio Gramsci, or Gramsci. He was an Italian Marxist. He wrote this book in prison under Mussolini. And this sort of hacking, a lot of people now talk about the long march through the institutions of the left. Okay. How did the left take over the culture? And Gramsci actually saw the revolutionary potential of all of this from, quote unquote, within capitalism. Okay. How are you going to capture the hearts and the minds of the people without even picking up a gun? Okay. And again, it's all of these methods that I've looked at. So there are two sides of it, really. But Benes is more the practical side, how to actually do it, the actual on-the-ground tactics. Gramsci is more the kind of theoretical side. Why would you want to do this? What could be the potential benefits of it from a communist point of view? Okay, I'm not suggesting, by the way, that Benes was a communist. I'm just saying that these are two sides of looking at the same problem. There are other theorists you can look at as well. But when, you know, people talk about the quote-unquote culture wars, right, the culture wars, but nobody seems to want to talk about how it actually works. What are the actual mechanisms of it? You know, if you were going to try to get your particular brand of whatever it happens to be out there, what would you have to do? Okay. I actually believe that some version of this is happening right now. As one example, there's been this big explosion of alternative political spaces. And I've talked before about how I believe independent voices are being attacked and crowded out by basically controlled voices, okay, in exactly this manner. Okay, it's always the same playbooks over and over again. And that's just because possibly that's how human societies and cultures work, right? I mean, especially if you want to hack them, especially if you want to control them, okay? And this is an underrated part of politics. It's also why various authoritarian regimes in the past have just cracked down on any attempts to, like, run your own newspaper or run your own record label, or they've wanted controls on those sorts of things, or some, you know, commissar or government, government agent looking over your shoulder to ensure you're doing it in the right way. Because if you don't do all of those things, of course, there's nothing stopping some organized group doing all of the things that we've said. And lo and behold, you've lost your quote-unquote culture. So there's actually a reason why historically authoritarian regimes have done that sort of thing. Again, for good or for ill, I'm sure there are all sorts of bad, there are all sorts of bad things that come from repression of that nature. Okay, I'm trying to give you a kind of value-free analysis of the nuts and bolts of, you know, what you'd need to do if you wanted to hack a culture from the top down. All right, let me know if you have any questions or comments. I think this is a very interesting area. One of the reasons I made this video is because I mentioned a couple of these features of jazz on Twitter, and I got quite a bit of pushback from various people. I'm afraid to say I simply just have read more on this topic than those people. And those people have a child's kind of naive view of how the culture works. And okay, in this case, we're talking about 1910s jazz, but you can actually update it for any era. Okay. Many of these methods were used, we know, to push certain style of modern art in the 1940s and 50s. This is that book, Who Paid the Piper, talks about how America wanted to push Jackson Pollock as a symbol of American freedom as against Soviet social realism, okay? CIA-led, okay? Another example that, I mean, some people might think of rap music. I saw a statistic the other day that rap music is only really liked by about 6% of the population, and yet that has been relentlessly pushed for years now, for decades. Not just on those communities, but in the culture more broadly. So there are many other examples. There are examples of genres that were popular with the public, well loved by the public, that for almost no reason whatsoever were pulled, or were they stopped making them, or they wouldn't put them on anymore. One such genre was the Western. I know that Devin Stack has got videos that he's put out there looking at this precise process as to why are these things like Home on the Prairie or, those kind of the Waltons or things like that. Like, what happened to them? Why were they put away when they were really popular? Like, why did the Western stop being popular? You can have a look at, the kind of child narrative, the naive narrative is to say, the public's tastes changed. Tastes just changed. That's what happened. But actually, it was a deliberate decision. It was a top-down decision by some controller somewhere, okay? And when I say controller, I don't mean that in a clandestine way. I mean it in the way that the guy who does the bookings for Carnegie Hall is a controller, okay? A decision-maker in the system. This is true of everything, by the way, not just booking music acts. Like, for example, there's a controller, a procurement officer, in charge of bringing product online for Tesco's and Sainsbury's, okay? If you want a product on the shelf in Tesco's and Sainsbury's, there is a whole politics around not only getting it on the shelf, but where in the supermarket it is positioned. Is it on the top shelf or the middle shelf? Is it at, eye level? Or do you have to look up or down? Like, there's a premium. There's a whole, science behind product placement in a supermarket, okay? Now, people who defend this system or who say, everything's emergent or it's just market forces, blah, 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 okay? They kind of overlook the fact that you're basically nudged and pushed into, hold on a second. This, right, you go into a shop, you see the product right on the eye level. It's there. Or, I mean, a good example is when they put the chocolate bars just by the checkout. Maybe I will take a Mars bar or something, okay? They're, all of these things have been thought of. They are actual, they're not an accident, right? They are actual decisions. Some of the companies who get those products placed in those places pay a premium for those products to be there, okay? So it is not simply just the decisions of consumers on an aggregate level, okay, and people voting product in and out of existence as per Milton Friedman free market dogma, okay? There's actually, there are forces, controllers, you might say, who are responsible for making some of those choices that are ostensibly yours, but kind of nudging you along, right? Nudging you along. How many people just picked up the Mars bar because it was right there by the till, as an example, okay? So this is something that I'm going to keep on insisting on, because it's important not to lose sight of the top-down elements in the decision-making process. And the fact that your dreams, your hopes, your decisions, right, are not ever fully your own, okay? I mean, from some point of view, you could say they are your own. But let's have a look at this in this case. I know it's kind of a cartoon level, but these guys, if you went up and talked to them after they were saying this sort of thing, and you said, oh, look, just a couple of years ago, you guys were completely against this. Now you're all for it. You've been brainwashed. You two can't think for yourselves. You two, right, have allowed Edward Bernays or whoever it was to change your dreams. Okay, you've had your dreams programmed by the likes of Bernays. They would say, oh, poppycock, old chap. That's a conspiracy theory, old chap, they'd say. Oh, don't you think I can think for myself? I just like this sort of music. Okay, yeah, so you understand how insidious it is, because people then, when challenged, become incredulous on it. They generate their copes. All right, I've talked enough now. I think I've made the point. I'm really fascinated to know what people think about this one. As I said, pick up the Trivium. If you do the Foundations of Rhetoric, there's quite a lot of this sort of persuasion material in there if you're interested. And I will see you later on for reviewing Adam Curtis. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.